Thank you. Gosh, hearing all this background of physics makes me feel like I should apologize. I was in physics once, way back in the 60s, and you'll think I forgot everything I once knew. That's what happens sometimes when you go into biology. So I'm going to, let's see, is this movable? No, I guess not. I better be over here. Let me start with this quote from an article in Science last year from Sidney Brenner, who said that the problems faced in either pre- or post-genomic genetics are much the same. They all involve bridging this gap between the genotype with the information in the DNA and the phenotype, the expression of that information in the whole organism. And as you all heard just a month or so ago, there was a draft of the human genome was released, and there were some surprises in there, that there were fewer genes than expected relative to the number of proteins. And this has really emphasized the importance of the intervening circuitry between the DNA sequence and the protein pattern that whose expression yields the phenotype of the organism. And so it's yeah. Yeah. No, actually, what they're finding is that there are many sophisticated ways by which you can recombine these pieces of genetic information to yield more proteins than you would have stated from the gene sequence itself. And that's really then why I say it emphasizes the network that goes between these. How do you take a smaller number of supposedly gene sequences, however you define gene, I guess, and out of that create the array of proteins that we see in higher organisms relative to what we see, say, in a fly or a worm. And of course, there are problems then of the evolution and robustness of the regulatory mechanisms that are manifested in these circuits. So what I'd like to do is to divide this talk into three parts. First, to give you a little background of what I mean by a gene circuit. And then in the second part, give some and lead up to two ways of approaching the analysis of these circuits. One way is to look at real small circuits, elementary circuits, and try and discover design principles, if you like, for these small circuits, such that if you had rules for the elementary pieces, you could start to begin to put them together in various ways using those rules and understand the larger network. That's one approach. And the other is simply to take an existing network and try and integrate all the information about that network, including its evolution and its expression in the intact organism. So I'm going to try and give you examples of each of those two different approaches to trying to understand the function of a gene circuit. So, what is the function of this gene circuitry? And the superficial answer, if you like, is indicated in the top here. That is, the genotype is determined by the information encoded in the DNA sequence. Everybody believes that. The phenotype, by the context-dependent expression of that information. And the role of circuitry, then, is to interpret the context that the organism finds itself in and orchestrate the patterns of expression that respond to that context. And that's certainly true, and everybody, I think, would accept that. But as you begin to look more deeply in this, what you find is there's no simple relationship between the gene sequence and the phenotype. There are many different levels in the hierarchy of mechanisms between those two levels of expression. And at each of those levels, there are a diversity of designs that nobody really knows why they're there. It raises this question, are those accidents that are just historical accidents that end up doing the job, and evolution is kind of sloppy, it discovers these, and they work, so it sticks with them? Or are there really rules that we could discover at each of these different levels? Rules that would allow us to say when there is going to be one of these designs used in a given situation, and maybe a different design in a different situation. If we could predict that, that would be nice. So let me just go through what I mean by these different hierarchical levels And starting with the sequence itself, this mind-numbing list of letters, and in fact, there is already some structure, some organization, some rules, of course, which we know exist at this level. We know that there is a four-letter code. We know there's a triplet codon usage between the DNA and the protein level. And we know that there's some grammar about how these segments of the sequence are organized. And so there are already some rules even at this level of the hierarchy. But if you go up one level higher, then this is an example of the kind of syntax or grammar that exists in that sequence information. You have here coding sequences for two genes, G1 and G2. There's a start site, which is called a promoter, and this is the simplest case in the bacterial system. And there's a terminator sequence, which marks the ends of these coding regions. There are regulatory regions upstream, an initiator site or an operator site, in which regulators, through their interaction with those sites, can alter the expression of those genes, G1 and G2. Okay, if you look at that regulatory interaction, there are two fundamentally different ways in which control is exercised at those upstream regions. On the top panel, you see the classical negative mode of regulation. This is the mode discovered by Jacob and Monod back in the 60s. And it says that you have a gene sequence in which there is some negative or restraining element bound to those upstream regions, and it blocks expression. In order to get induction of gene expression, you have to remove that restraining element and you get transcription on the right. That's one way, one mechanism for turning on a gene, if you like. On the bottom panel is another method, and that is you have a set of genes which are normally quiescent, and they need to have something positive supply to turn them on. So that's the positive mode of control. So you can see the same physiological function, that is induction of gene expression here, realized in two different ways. One by removal of a negative element, or the other supplying a positive element. And again, this is one of these examples where when it was first discovered, molecular biologists said, so what? You know, this is just chance. Evolution discovers each of these mechanisms. They do the same thing. So what? And we'll see there's a rule which governs this evolution of these modes of control. That's just one control. In fact, what you often find are multiple regulators that interact with some logic to determine the expression of a set of genes. So here's the simplest case of two regulators. In this case, if I said that the regulator R1 has that positive mode of control and R2 has a negative mode, then if you look at the presence or absence of those two regulators, you can see the expression pattern predicted on the right for two different logical functions, a simple AND function or a logical OR. And we'll come back to this as well. So once you turn on a gene with some logic, that's just the beginning. If you look at the transcriptional event, it leads to the production of a specific messenger RNA. And that, in turn, acts as a catalyst, if you like, to polymerize a specific protein. And that protein, in turn, can catalyze specific reactions to yield various metabolites. So you have this cascade of expression that follows from that simply turning on the transcription of a particular gene. And this cascade can have various modes of regulation, different feedback paths and so forth. And so that brings up the next level, which is the connectivity of these cascades, expression cascades. And here's the simplest case or you can think about. Here are two expression cascades. The one on the right, we might call an effector cascade. Its messenger RNA leads to, say, an enzyme which catalyzes a reaction that leads to some metabolite, which could be used for growth of the organism. The cascade on the left leads to a regulatory protein, but that protein has no catalytic function. And then it's the combination of small molecular weight signaling molecules, like this metabolite, and regulators, like shown on the left, that interact to affect the transcription of each of those messenger RNAs. So you can see the connectivities, the sort of wiring that brings the parts of these two cascades together and affects they mutually affect each other's expression. So that's the simplest or elementary kind of circuit that you can think about. So what I want to talk about then from here on is based on the molecular information that's been accumulated over the last 50 years or so. So it's based on this molecular revolution. And it's to the point where, for many of the simple organisms, simple bacteria or some of the simple viruses, that we know essentially all the parts. We have the parts catalog, if you like, all the proteins, all the gene sequences, and so forth. But still, we lack any systemic understanding of these organisms. And the evidence for that is, as indicated here, that we can't predict the behavior in response to a novel change in the genome. Even if we have that complete gene sequence, we can't say what would happen if you change this G to a C. Similarly, we have no ability to predict the response in a novel environment. Suppose you put a bacterium in some environment where it's exposed to a man-made chemical that's never been seen before. Can we predict what would happen? Absolutely not. This is just a measure of how far we have to go if we really want systemic understanding, that is, to be able to make any sort of prediction of this nature. So let me state the goal, and this is a long-term goal, an idealistic goal, if you like, but the idea really is that we'd like to be able to elucidate and to quantify complex web of interactions that link these numerous hierarchical levels of organization all the way from the DNA sequence to the behavior of the organism in its natural environment. And at the third part of the talk, I'll try and take one example that goes all the way across those levels and see if I can't show you that you get some interesting results from that. So, I'm going to talk about two different ways of approaching the function of these circuits. And before I do that, let me mention, when I talk about function, that means different things to different people. Right now, when people talk about function in a genomic context, they're often talking about what is the function of a protein. We have a DNA sequence. What does that code for? Can we predict what kind of a protein, what its function? Is it a kinase? Does it do something that we can understand in a particular context? When I talk about function, I'm talking about the function of this network, this system. And some of its functions might include the fact that it has to be stable, it has to be robust, it has to be sensitive to certain signals, it has to perform certain functions, it has to be an inducible gene circuit, and so on. Function, I'm talking about a systemic function, not just the function of a protein. So, two different ways of studying systemic function. One is to look for functions that are exhibited by a class of systems. So the idea here is that you'd like to look at a class that has many members in it. So if you can find some rule or some prediction that you can make for this class of systems, that you can have many examples to test the rule. Okay, and so that's one of the features. We'd like to explain, if we can, examples where you have a class of systems where there's a nearly universal design. That is, you seem to find the same design over and over again across different systems within an organism, between different organisms in an evolutionary sense. Why does that occur over and over again? We'd like to understand that. The other case that's very common is to find, as I showed you just a moment ago, cases where there's alternative designs for what appears to be doing the same thing. And can we come up with some rules that would explain when each of those alternative designs might be used in nature? So those are the kinds of things we'd like to do with that first approach. And since we're talking about fairly generic questions involving a class, these are often going to be qualitative kinds of predictions. That is, something that you're predicting that's present or absent, that something goes up or goes down, that it belongs to the positive or negative mode, this sort of question. It's not going to be dependent on particular parameter values. Not going to be dependent on whether it's 2.3 or 2.35 for some particular interaction, but rather is a fairly generic property that governs a class of systems. So that's an approach that we like a lot. We can't claim that we've been extremely successful, although we have found some rules with that sort of approach. The other approach is to look at a particular system, where you try and gather all the information you can about that system. That is, measure every kinetic parameter you can, every thermodynamic property, put all that information together into a model of that particular system, and try and reproduce or to mimic the behavior of the actual system. And with that model, then hope to better understand that particular system. That's probably the more common approach. That does tend to yield results which are more dependent on the numerical properties, the quantitative properties of the systems. It also doesn't necessarily generalize very well to other cases. And if you're looking at a particular or unique system, you don't have any other tests but that system that you've been examining. So sometimes you worry that you put in all the information that it's, you've got to make some predictions that that aren't something you already put into it. So I'm going to show you examples of each of these two different ways of approaching function. First, the design principles. Well, let me come back to this question of the molecular mode of gene control. As I say, this is a fundamental dualism, I think, in any control mechanism, that you can realize it in these two different ways. You find this duality in the immune system where you have helper cells and suppressor cells. You find it in biochemical regulation where you have activators and inhibitors. And of course, in gene control, you have repressors and activators as well. And so the question is, why are there these differences? And you can actually go through a rather straightforward selectionist kind of argument, and based on the logic of those two different control mechanisms in looking at them in different environments, you can predict when an organism will evolve each of those two different designs. So the prediction is that you expect the positive mode of control, when if you look at the regulatable characteristic of this inducible gene circuit, say, if it operates at the high end of the regulatable region most of the time in its natural environment, then you predict that you'll select for a positive mode of control. If it's at the low end of the regulatable region most of the time in its natural environment, you predict the selection of a negative mode of control. And basically, the argument says that when you look at each of those different kinds of mechanisms in these different environments, if you don't have these conditions met, that the mutants, the mutants in these conditions get selected against. And so you enrich for the functional control mechanism in these particular combinations of mode and environment. And this is something we can go through in more detail later if you like. But let me just tell you that there's a fair amount of experimental evidence to support these predictions. This is a fairly dated slide, but if you look at systems where there is a single demand function, if you like, a single environmental situation in which it finds itself. And these studies are mostly done in bacteria where we have good molecular data so that we know whether the control mechanism at the molecular level is a positive one or a negative one, and also that we know something about its environment so that we know whether the gene is expressed at a high level or a low level most of the time. And there's more than 100 cases, and there is not an exception to that rule when you've got good information at both the molecular level and the ecology level, if you like. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Great question. And that's what I'm coming to here. When I said single demand function, it's like a bacterium which is in a rather homogeneous environment. So it's one demand, if you like. But there are functions that are related to each other, and they get coupled logically, if you like. Some functions have to go together, and some functions have to be reciprocal, and each of those logical couplings allows you to predict what the mode would be in those cases. And there are about 20 examples of those kinds of tests where the logic all fits together. And then the third case is just what you're talking about. When we first thought about this in terms of higher organisms, where like you have differentiated cell types, you have heart muscle and you have brain and so forth, kidney, same set of genes, but in certain cells a gene might be turned on and therefore in high demand in one cell type and in low demand in another cell type. So what's the situation here? Well, the dumb application of this rule says that you should have, say, in the kidney-specific cells, where the kidney-specific functions are in high demand, those genes ought to be positively regulated. But if you look in heart muscle, those kidney genes are in low demand, so it should be negatively regulated. So it predicts two modes of control that are of opposite type. And when a cell differentiates from being one cell type to another, you have to switch the regulatory mechanism. And when we first went through that dumb application of the rule, that seemed kind of strange. Why can't you just do it with one control system and turn the gene on or off? Why do you have to have this switching? Well, it's because selection will maintain it if you have this. And it turns out that in many model systems, simple model systems in bacteria and in bacteriophages, you find exactly that situation. And I'll give you an example later. Yeah. You're asking all the good questions. In fact, what I said in the beginning was that this argument was a selectionist argument, and it was a logical argument and gives you a sort of yes or no answer. But that question obviously is one that cries out to the answer. What do you mean by high and what do you mean by low? Where is the dividing line between this? And originally, we just took extreme cases where we knew it was high or low to sort of formulate the rule. But I'm going to talk in the second part about quantifying the notion of demand. What do you mean by high and low in a quantitative sense? So I'll come back to that. It's a selectionist argument that says, suppose you take a positive control mechanism for some gene that's in an organism that requires the expression of those genes all the time. Take an extreme case. Okay, the wild type will have induced those genes and used the expression to grow and divide and so forth. If you mutate the positive regulator, those genes all of a sudden turn off, they can't be used in an environment where their demand is high. So those mutants are going to be selected against. In the negative case, you want a situation where genes are normally turned off, okay, and in low demand, where they should be. But now if you mutate the negative control system, what happens is the genes get turned on spontaneously in an inappropriate way, in the wrong time, in the wrong environment. And that's wasteful, for one thing. It uses up material and energy when it isn't needed. But also, when you express, particularly when you express regulatory genes or certain genes at inappropriate time, they interfere with other functions. And so those mutants also will be selected against, and you'll enrich for the negative control mechanism in that low demand state. So that's the essence of the argument.
Both, if you inverted the argument, it would sound just pretty logical. That if you said that those that are in high demand should be negative and those that are in low demand should be positive, it would be just the same. What is the connection between the two mechanisms and the high versus low demand?
Well, it'd be interesting to see why you feel that is logically just as convincing. Because I think there is a sort of counterintuitive feeling about this. That's come up many times before. But again, take it the other way around. Suppose you had a high demand, a gene in a high demand situation where you required its expression all the time for the cell to grow, but it had negative control. Okay? That's what you were saying. Now what happens is that repressor is removed to turn those genes on anyway. So if you mutate it, in fact, you can. In fact, entropy will, in fact, degrade that repressor. And you won't know the difference. So you'll keep turning that gene on. And with time, well, yeah, you're right. What you mean by, when I say high demand, I mean frequently expressed, the high level of its regulatable region in its natural environment. So that means either that it's on all the time, or it wouldn't, you know, not the spike of activity that you might have where it's required at some particular time. It has to be on, and that's...
I guess what I'm saying is there's a class of cases where the failure of both mechanisms would be equally fatal. So it's hard to decide on that logic.
But you see, if a mechanism is not being used for long periods of time, they will accumulate mutations, and you'll tend to lose that function with drift. That's basically the argument. But why you get enrichment for the wild-type control mechanism in one environment, and in the other environment it'll drift. So it's a question of how much selection and how much drifting goes on. And that gets back to the quantitative argument, is where do you draw that line? How frequently do you do that? Do you have a, you know, if you have a spike, how wide does that spike have to be to have an influence? And we're going to come back to that in the second part, but yeah.
Yeah, I also agree that this is sort of somewhat counterintuitive. I can imagine, I like the idea that this is sort of an evolutionarily stable strategy or whatever, but there are, I'm trying to imagine though how to get there from here. You know, it seems to originate when you leave a gene on, it would seem the first thing that would happen is you would get the gene and then you would get the control mechanism. And you would expect under that circumstance, it seems difficult to evolve an always on control mechanism. What I'm wondering about is, imagine you just had 50% positive control, 50% negative control, and the only thing that could survive would be the positive control in this situation because of the arguments that you make, which would mean that there would be a lot of genes that would be unregulated. Are there, mm-hmm. is bacteria, lots of unregulated genes that are just constantly on that would represent the rise of the other strategy where the control mechanism just, as you mentioned, decayed away?
Now, you're all picking up all the subtle points of the simple argument, because that's the second part of the talk. And you're right. There is a sense in which, and also, this isn't an argument at this point about the de novo arising of these control mechanisms. This is an explanation for the maintenance of different kinds of controls in different situations. And we haven't really talked about how that would evolve out of nothing. In terms of the other side of that argument, seeing the loss of control, there are examples of that. For example, the lac operon in bacteria, in E. coli, that colonizes your intestinal system. That's a system where it very seldom sees lactose. So it's off most of the time in the bacterium, and it's controlled by the classical Jacobi-owned repressor. So it fits with the notion of low demand, it's hardly ever used, and it's negative control. Okay? But if you take a lactose intolerant patient and drink dairy products, milk, and so forth, and they have cramps and, you know, and so forth, gas and whatnot, in the clinics, you'll find that when they isolate coliforms from those patients, that the lac operon is constitutive. It's if you change the environment from a where it seldom sees lactose to one where it's being perfused in lactose, you tend to lose the negative control system. Okay, so that's the half of, you can lose a mechanism, but I don't know whether there's any examples of gaining one that's been experimentally demonstrated, if you like.
Returning to the simple thing.
Yeah.
So it seems your argument is predicated on the idea that mutations usually weaken protein DNA binding.
Yeah. Well, it's the notion that there is a very specific interaction between a regulatory protein and its binding site in the DNA, and there are many more ways that you can disrupt that recognition than there are to facilitate it. So it is kind of an entropy argument that says that with time, most mutations are going to destroy that interaction. Use it or lose it. Yep.
It's interesting though, because in the last example, differentiated cell-specific functions, it seems like either positive control or negative control both would be evolutionarily stable in that you lose function in either direction and you die or whatever. So it doesn't seem like in that example there would be a need for one or the other or switching back and forth.
But it's exactly the switching back and forth. That's a situation where every time the organism goes through development and so forth, it has to switch the expression of the genes. And it's actually putting the genes in different environments that leads to the selection of the different pieces of the control system. And I'm trying to give you a specific example of that in the third part.
One more possible connection.
Yeah.
With non-linearity. Depending on what is more dangerous, overproduced or underproduced, truly it's non-linear. You're using down or up.
In all of
it is more dangerous to overproduce, so you inhibit it essentially. If it is more dangerous underproduce, you enhance it essentially.
Well, in the development of this rule, that's something we control against by saying that the two genes are going to have the same level of expression, so that's sort of controlled for that. And you're getting at another point, and that is that in addition to this idea of demand, which is sort of a duty cycle kind of idea, how frequently a gene is on or off, there is another notion, which is the capacity for gene regulation. That is the difference between a basal level and a fully expressed level. There's nonlinearity in all these systems, but there's also just this, this issue will come up to be important in the next rule we're going to talk about. Yeah? Okay, there's two points we've got to be very clear about here. When I use the words positive and negative mode of control, this is not positive and negative feedback. So we're not confusing that, I hope. Because the same function can be realized in either of these modes, positive or negative. I lost my train of thought. Must have been a good question anyway. but how clear is it that you have positive negative control? The basic experimental test is that if you knock out the gene for one of these regulators, if you just do away with the repressor gene, you find constitutive expression of the regulated genes. If you knock out the gene for an activator, you get suppression of expression of the regulated genes. And that's the classic test that biologists use to deduce whether something is positively or negatively controlled. It's the function of that protein is either essential for the function or it's essential for the repression of the function. And when you remove it, you get the expression manifested that goes along with the positive or negativeness of it.
It seems that if you were to just sort of make a more global rule to this, the more global rule would be create your circuit so that mutations do the most possible damage, as a way of, in that way you're sort of kept in that type of thing. It seems though that the result of knockout mutations and things like that seem to be that these circuitry have an incredible robustness to them. So trying to reconcile the robustness of these gene circuits with mm-hmm. this that says, always make things as precarious as possible.
But you could have a situation where you have some isoforms of a particular transcriptional activator, and they're sort of redundant, right? So, I don't think it's sure necessarily.
But I would expect in that case that I would move six of them. Because of this.
Well, if you knock down for one of them and you see the mouse doesn't die, you go, then what happened?
My bias in looking at those knockout data for higher organisms is to say that these organisms evolved in many different environments. And when we look in a laboratory under one environment and knock out a gene, we don't see any effect. To me, that means that we haven't looked hard enough. Uh-huh. If we put it in some other environment, you may well find some phenotype of that knockout. But if it were purely redundant, you're right. This argument says that you have a hard time maintaining redundancy in these kind of selectionist arguments. Because if you had several things doing exactly the same function, you'd start to mutate them away and nothing ever happened. There's no selection against those, so it would drift. And you'd find, eventually you'd lose the redundancy. Well, that's a hard question to get at, actually.
Yet there are, yet they find situations like this. And I'm not arguing that there are things that do exactly the same thing. I mean, like your argument that, why knock this out, they don't see anything. I mean, it could be a very, not everything can reflect on the phenotype, not in there's only time.
Right.
But, you can't, it's not bigger, it's not small, the mouse is okay.
Right. Well, they're subtle effects, but it may be that we haven't looked at all the environments that organism evolved in, and that you might find that in the 7-year drought or something, that all of a sudden that gene becomes very important. But it is a difficult question to resolve that, whether the apparent lack of phenotype is due to, or the robustness, if you like, is due to redundancy, or whether it's due to the nonlinear controls that are in these systems.
And your argument
Yeah.
But this is
the simplest case where the rule first was discovered, was to try and simplify it to cases in bacteria where we knew what the environment was, and there were good genetic studies to know that there's a predominant control that was either positive or negative.
Okay.
Well, the way it got started was that E. coli can use many different carbon sources, many different sugars, for example, and yet they don't make the machinery to use all those sugars all the time. They keep them turned off unless they're induced when they're needed. And the question is, how do you control that induction? And half of them are positive and half of them are negative. And it turns out that you can relate that, and that's most of these 100 cases, are to whether that sugar is frequently in the environment or it's very rare in the environment.
So you would expect, or make a prediction that in Lenski's experiments, E. coli, that I would expect there to be a rapid decrease in the observed robustness of the E. coli to knockouts and things like that because of the redundancy being that we've known and stable.
I would like to see some other experiments that he would do to more specifically test, instead of growing them in glucose minimal medium, you know, let's look at some interesting sugars that vary and look at variable environments. And I think that would really test some of these ideas. Yeah, there could be cases where that's an amplification mechanism, because, you know, as you change from growing very slowly to a feast situation where you turn on protein synthesis, the most abundantly expressed genes are the ribosomal genes. That you crank up all that protein synthesis machinery, and it could be that you need multiple copies to amplify that machinery very quickly. But
they still evolve, but they evolve in some of them.
Yeah.
So there's correlated mutations in all of the various.
I don't say they come up all at once, but they maintain and you isolate multiple copies from the cell. You can't find machines.
Let me move on. Yeah, that may be an example which is not a different function. It's the same function, but when you need to express it at different levels, that's an amplifying mechanism. The same thing is true in drug resistance. You can amplify the genes, which are the same structure and same function, but you produce many more copies to deal with that challenge. But in terms of different functions, and having redundant ways to deal with those, anyway, I guess we're supposed to move on. This is only the second example then of a design principle, if you like. So here are two elementary circuits that I showed you before. And the question is, you can couple expression of these two circuits in only three logical ways. You can, if you induce the function on the right, and here is the induction as a function of the substrate concentration. And if you look at the regulator, you can either induce that regulator, and we'd call that direct coupling, that is, they tend to go in the same direction. Or you could repress the expression of that regulator so they go in opposite directions, or it doesn't change, that is, they're uncoupled. And those are really the only three possibilities. So, and there are examples of all three of those forms of coupling in the literature. So the question is there any rule that governs that form of coupling? And in fact, this is where the question about the capacity for regulation, that is, the difference between this basal level and the maximum level, turns out to be the parameter which causes bifurcation into these different forms of coupling, if you like. So this is a situation where it isn't a logical argument so much as a dynamical argument. You analyze those circuits, and you ask, when are there advantages to each of those forms of coupling? And the criteria that you're judging these circuits on are things like stability, robustness, temporal responsiveness, sensitivity to the signal, and so forth. And when you analyze those alternatives, you get these predictions. That is, the regulator can be either positive or negative, like we just described. And then, if you look at the capacity for regulation, whether it's low or high, you get different forms of coupling predicted. That is, when it's a positive control and a low capacity, you expect this inverse coupling. And when you have positive control and a high capacity for regulation, you get direct coupling. And with the negative mode of control, everything is just reversed. So with the low capacity, you get direct coupling. And with high capacity, you predict inverse coupling. No, this is analyzing that little circuit, that coupled circuit that I showed you, and asking when you find advantages for each of the form of coupling. And you vary the mode and the capacity, and you get the predicted forms of coupling on the right. Okay? Capacity is the difference between the basal level of expression and the maximal level. So you can have a gene, like for the synthesis of a vitamin, that has very low capacity. It doesn't make very much of it, but it could be high demand because it's on all the time. Whereas something like beta-galactosidase can have a huge capacity for regulation, that is 2,000-fold difference, and yet it's hardly ever used. So it has a low demand but high capacity and so forth. So there are two different, keep those two things distinct. So after those predictions were made, we went to the literature. And this is what I mentioned earlier about the advantage of having a class of systems where there are many examples you can test it with. We found 35 or so examples in the literature where people had actually measured the coupling in a sense. And this plot shows the capacity for expression of the effector gene on the horizontal axis. So that's the difference between the basal and the full expression of the regulated function. And on the vertical axis is the capacity for the regulator expression, okay? And the dotted line through zero would mean that there's no change in the regulator. And when you go up, you have a positive, you have an increase or induction of the regulator. When you go below zero, you have repression. So the closed circles represent the positive systems. Remember the correlation there was such that when you have a high demand for expression, or I should say a high capacity for expression with the positive mode, you expect direct coupling. And so you get those higher than the dotted line. And when it's very low, you get a few down here where it's inverse coupling, which is consistent with the predictions we made. The open circles are the negative mode of control. And again, for the low capacity ones, we predict direct coupling. And the high capacity should be inverse coupling. We don't see any inverse couplings in this data set we looked at. We find some that are uncoupled. We don't know why there aren't any we found that are inversely coupled when there's a negative mode. It could be we just haven't looked at, you know, it's only 35. There will be some someday. Or whether there's something about the negative mode that we haven't taken into account here, which makes somehow this is a forbidden region. But in any case, for the positive, certainly there's you have to realize these data were not collected so as to test this hypothesis. This is all after the fact. So these are measured in different labs, different conditions, and there's a lot of air in there probably. But still, we take that as being consistent with those predictions. Yeah?
Quick question.
Yes, it's a you've got a combination of mode of control, which is positive or negative, and because there are closed loops, there are positive and negative effects. And but these are all inducible systems. That is, the end effect of adding a substrate is to turn on the gene. If I were to go back to that circuit, the inducer interacts with the regulator, and it can the net effect is to stimulate this transcriptional unit. The interaction over here can be either to stimulate it or repress it. Exactly. Interacting with the regulatory protein. Yeah. The mode of control here is the same. You've got a regulator which can be positive or negative mode. And in fact, that's one of the parameters that distinguish between these behaviors. But here, it's interesting that the analysis is a more dynamical one, whereas before it was kind of a logical argument about selection. Well, you write the differential equations for each of the species in this model, and it's a nonlinear set of differential equations, which has the feedback and so forth in there, and it has the topology in there, and it has the different interaction, mode of interactions, positive or negative. And you analyze the dynamics of that system to come up with those predictions that I just
so
had on it.
When you said there was an advantage to having it as you described it,
right.
That means you can't build a circuit that doesn't?
No. You can have all of those, you can have all of these three different coupling patterns observed in nature. But the question is, when do you find each one of them? And the prediction says that it depends on the mode and the capacity for regulation. So we vary the mode and the capacity, analyze these circuits, and find out when each of the couplings produce the best behavior.
Okay,
I mentioned the criteria, things like stability, okay, local stability, things like robustness, things like
stability.
Dynamic stability. Perturb the variables, does it? Right. Exactly. Response time, how long does it take to induce this gene? Right.
Okay.
So, dynamic criteria like that. Yeah.
Is there enough data there to really assess that for these systems?
Well, this is actually a case where it was done without specific data. There are, except for the response times, I should qualify that. The robustness you can actually analyze analytically. And you can show that having, for example, the regulator be a negative mode, have a negative mode of action on its own expression, makes those circuits more robust than the opposite. So you predict that all the regulators should have a negative mode of control on their own expression. Things like that. Right. To get at the robustness, we ask what is the change in the output of this circuit in response to changes in all the parameters. So you make the calculations from the equations. What is the change, the local change in the response of the system to a change in a parameter? And you ask when is that minimum? And you take the ratio from, say, the directly coupled circuit to one where there's uncoupling, and you ask which one has the greater robustness, so the minimum parameter sensitivity. We take a logarithmic derivative or a relative derivative, you're right. Yeah, this is all published. In fact, I think it's on the, this paper here will give you references to that. Okay. Okay, let me try and get one through the design principles, and then that would be a good place to break. So here's the last of the design principles I wanted to give you. Okay, here are two different kinds of switches. Okay, on the right is what we call a static switch. As you increase the substrate, the expression goes up by some sigmoid kind of response, and if you reduce the substrate, it traverses the same curve back again. That switch can be made very steep by having it be very cooperative, so you could have something that's a hill function with high degree of cooperativity, and you get a very steep switch, but it's still static. And you move up and down, traversing the same path. On the left, of course, is a dynamic switch with hysteresis, and as you exceed this threshold, and it snaps up to the upper state, and you go back. When you go below this threshold, it snaps back to the other state, and those are dynamic property. So when you get each of these two different kinds of switches, and here I'm going to relate it to two kinds of sort of connectivity or circuitry, if you like, in simple inducible systems. You have in the case on the left, a case where you have induction of an enzyme which catalyzes the conversion of the substrate to an inducer, but it doesn't affect the degradation of that inducer, and you get the conditions for that dynamic switch. And on the right, you have a case which is actually the case for the lac operon in its natural state, where the inducer synthesis and degradation are both influenced by the enzymes that are induced. And in this case, you get a static switch. And these diagrams in the bottom, what they're meant to represent is if you look at the signal propagation from the inducer through the effect on transcription through translation to the enzyme, just that much of it, the open circuit that far, that's this S-shaped curve, which is idealized here. If you look at the signal going from the enzyme to the inducer, that's this line here, this sloping line, which is a function of the substrate concentration. Different fixed values of the substrate concentration, the signal from enzyme to inducer is simply this relationship here. So you can see that the intersection of these two give you the stationary states for this system. And if you start off with very low substrate, you're way over here, the only intersection is on the bottom. And as you move across, the intersection comes to here. And any further increase, it snaps up to this state. And you go backward, the same thing here. Whereas in this case, since the enzyme, the signal again from inducer all the way to the enzyme is the same here, but now the signal propagation from the enzyme to the inducer you get different expression independent of the amount of the inducer. And for different substrate concentrations, this curve just shifts across, and you can see there's only one intersection that's possible. So you can predict each of these two different kinds of circuits for the lac operon in different states. And here's some experimental data which verifies that. This is a classic experiment that was done back in the 50s by Novick and Weiner. And they used a gratuitous inducer which bypasses the normal effect of the beta-galactosidase acting on the natural inducer. And you can see you get the hysteretic sort of response. And here's the natural situation where the natural substrate lactose is used and the internal inducer, allolactose, is affected in its synthesis and its degradation by the beta-galactosidase, and you don't get the dynamic switch. So just changing that interaction, that one interaction of the protein on the degradation of the inducer, makes this difference between dynamic and static switches. Okay, this is the last thing on this, that just to ask what's common to these kinds of explanations of design. And in all cases, they seem to be cases where there are a limited number of variations on the theme. We talked about the mode of control being positive and negative. There are only two possibilities. The different forms of coupling, there are only three, direct, indirect, and uncoupled. And with these two switches, there are only the two different types as well. And the second point that's common to all these is the equations which describe these circuits are fairly simple. And in fact, that means that we can even do some analysis, some qualitative analysis of these equations. And in some cases, when we need to actually look at timescales, we can do sort of exhaustive numerical analysis in a fairly straightforward fashion. Yeah. Well, actually, oops. No, it's that the permease and the beta-galactosidase are coordinately expressed, and you can lump those first two steps together before you get to the natural inducer, and you're still inducing the synthesis and the degradation of the inducer at the same rate, and that's what leads to the static switch. So that's a place to stop.
Okay. 5 minutes break. Reconvene 15
o'clock. 10 or 12?
No, 12 sharp.
12 sharp, anyway. And I've been given license to ignore certain questions. So I want to change the gears here and talk about one system looked at in more depth and get back to the quantitation of some of these issues we talked about earlier. And so I want to talk about the lac operon, just one gene system. And it's going to involve looking at the circuitry, the life cycle, and its demand for expression, mutation, the population dynamics, some mathematical analysis which allows us to quantify these rules for the demand theory, and finally predict the relationship between genotype and phenotype. So this is a circuit that's the current model of the Lac operon. You have induction of messenger RNA enzyme, which catalyzes both the conversion, and this is a two-step process, as someone noted, two-step process from the external substrate to the natural inducer inside the cell, and the same gene products catalyze the degradation as well. So here's the life cycle of E. coli. It normally colonizes your colon, the distal end of your small intestine, and its life cycle is such that it's got to move from you to another host and continue this cycle if it's to persist. And so in doing this, it goes through two different environments as far as the Lac operon is concerned. In the upper environment, that is your esophagus, stomach, and the first third of your small intestine, is what I'll call the high demand environment, because that's where it would see lactose. Okay, you ingest the malted milk with E. coli in it, and it's going to be exposed to that. When it reaches the one-third into your small intestine, there's a very active enzyme in your small intestine, a lactase enzyme, which splits the lactose into constituent sugars, the glucose and galactose. And after that, you don't see much free lactose, nor do you see much free lactose in the environment. So it goes through a low-demand environment as it passes through the rest of your intestinal system and maybe resides there for some time as it colonizes, but eventually it's got to go out and recolonize another host. So it's continually going through these two environments, high and low. And I'm going to define as the average cycle time the time it takes to go through the high demand and the low demand environment. And we'll call D the fraction of that cycle time in which the genes are turned on. Okay, that's the demand. So you can see that if D were 1, it would be on the whole time. And if D were 0, it would be off all the time. So D is going to vary and quantitate what we mean now by demand. Okay, now here are two different environments. The top foursome is the high demand environment, the lower is the low demand environment. So in the upper panel, what you see in the upper left-hand corner is the wild type mechanism. That is high demand, it's going to be turned on. The Lac operon is a negatively controlled system, so the repressor is removed physiologically and you get expression of the Lac operon. If you mutate the promoter, going to the right up there, then you don't get any expression. Okay, that'll be selected against in the high demand environment when you've got to express the genes. On the other hand, mutation in the repressor or the repressor binding site, the modulator site, that won't make any difference because you're turned on anyway. So now when you remove the repressor, it's turning on for genetic reasons, if you like. But so you're going to have all those mutations occurring and accumulating because there's no selective pressure on the left. And the double mutant is in the lower right-hand corner. Okay, in the low-demand environment, the wild type is turned off because the repressor is bound here, and you don't have any expression, and that's what you want in the low-demand environment. Now, if you mutate the promoter, nothing happens. It's turned off anyway. And so now this is drifting. These accumulate. But this kind of mutation now is selected against because as you knock out the repressor or its binding site, you get constitutive expression at inappropriate time and space, and these are selected against. So you can see that you have different parts of the control system under selection in different regimes. On the top, you've got the promoter under selection, and on the bottom here, you've got the repressor under selection.
At the beginning, you mentioned the cycle switching between high and low demand environment, but that period is much longer than the lifetime of the
We're going to come back to that. Okay. Okay, so this is what's happening with mutations. We're going to get to what happens now when you do the analysis. Here are four different populations. This foursome exists in each of those different environments, if you like. So there's the wild type. That's the number of wild type organisms. Here's the number of promoter mutants, the number of modulator mutants, and the double mutants. Each of those grows with a certain growth rate, G, and there's a certain mutation rate in each case. You can get that mutation rate by looking at the target size for promoters and the repressor and the Lac operon. All those are known from the gene sequence and so forth. And using the standard sort of estimates of mutation rates and so forth, you get all these parameters. And you get a pattern like this in the high-demand environment. And then when you switch to the low-demand environment, you have the same foursome, but the parameters are different. Different mutation rates, different growth rates, and so forth. So we're switching between two of these sorts of diagrams. And what you have is a recursive set of equations. In each of the environments, you have this little set of linear equations, the population dynamic equations. And when you go through one cycle, you get this recursive relationship, which tells you how many promoter mutants relative to the wild type you have when you have the number or the ratio given at some arbitrary time t. Here's one cycle later. So it's a recursive relationship that you get by solving the equations where the initial condition in the high-demand environment is the final condition in the low-demand environment, and so forth. You just solve those equations. And, of course, this is what it looks like, the ratio at some time, sometimes later. The intersection, of course, is a stable state where it'll tend to go. I haven't said anything yet about the demand, but it's a cycle, average cycle. Right, exactly. So, and of course, if you equate the time, the ratios at the two times, this is the equation for the steady state. And what you see are a set of parameters in for the low demand environment and a set for the high demand environment. They're embedded in this. But if you fix those parameters, this is a nonlinear equation in C and D. It's fairly complicated, but in fact, it has very nice asymptotic properties where you can predict what will happen in high and low values of the cycle time.
So this was population sizes?
Yes.
But there was just one-way errors in your population
diagram? Yes. Well, let's save that question for later. There's an argument that says that you can ignore this very small when you're talking about maintenance of the control mechanism. So these are what the asymptotic forms look like. And I was talking about the promoter equation. So for low values of C, you get this vertical asymptote. For high values of C, you get this thing. And you have to be to the right of those asymptotes in order to select for the promoter, the wild-type promoter. You do the same thing for the regulator-modulator site interaction. And you get these asymptotic forms, and you have to be to the left of those. So the shaded region in between is the only region in which you can select for both the wild-type promoter and wild-type regulator-modulator interaction. So that's the region of realizability. If you don't have C and D values in the shaded region, you can't maintain the wild-type control mechanism. That's what the theory says. Now, if you put in the actual numbers for the lac operon, the target sizes for the genes and promoters and so forth, mutation rates and whatnot, you get that. Actually, there's a point here. You get this, and you can see it's very close to those asymptotic forms that I showed you. They just round off the corners a bit in here and here. Now, one other piece of information I give you all of a sudden yields some very interesting predictions. The other interesting piece of information is that in clinics all over the world, people measure how long it takes for ingestion of lactose to get to that lactase enzymes in your small intestine. This is a test they do when they're dying to diagnose lactose intolerance. So they'll give you a bolus of lactose, and they'll measure how long it takes before it's all split. Turns out it's about 3 hours. Okay? So if you take that fixed period of 3 hours, that gives you a relationship between C and D. It says that C is basically 3 hours over D. And that's the equation of this straight line, this green line through here. So if you put that in with the rest of it, you start getting some interesting predictions. First of all, it tells you here is a prediction for the lowest value of cycle time. Okay? Turns out that's about 24 hours. Okay? If you ask how long does it take for a bolus of food to go through your intestinal system, it's about 12 to 48 hours. Okay, so what I would say is that that corresponds to just about how fast you can go through your intestinal system. You can imagine a nursery where kids are passing infection, a diarrheal infection, on from one to another. Just going through the system is about as fast as you can go, somewhere about there. Now, what is the other prediction here at this extreme? That's the longest cycle time that you can realize. That turns out to be 70 years, 66 years, okay? That's a long time. It's a log scale here on the left. So what does that correspond to? What I'd argue is that that corresponds to the lifetime of the host, okay? If you were a bacterium that had such a good affinity for the epithelial cells in one host and no other host that you would colonize that person for their entire life, if you didn't get out and colonize another host, you would die with the host. So you've got to have a cycle time to get you to another host before the host dies. I'm going to say that's the lifetime of the host. Another prediction that comes out of this, I showed you the... Yeah?
You're saying that if your cycle time is longer than 77 years, your bacteria are always... They're digesting lactose? Or
no. It can't... It can't, you can't maintain the control system.
You can't shut off the lactose.
In that case, where you're colonizing it for long periods of time, you're in the low demand environment all the time. You never cycle through the high demand environment.
Low demand environment. You lose the ability to process lactose if you die with your host.
Yeah, I think you'd lose it. but what that suggests is that E. coli, in the lac operon in particular, is adapted to this huge range of conditions, from cycling in a nursery with diarrheal infection spreading to colonizing a host for a long period of time up to its life. But I showed you those equations, those recursive equations, actually give you some dynamics. And so you can ask, what's the response time of this system? That is, suppose you perturb the system by throwing in mutants. How long does it take to come back to that steady state? So you can calculate the response time. And that's shown here. This is the response time as a function of the demand. And so if you're very low demand, it takes a long time to get back to the steady state distribution. And it drops to this sort of plateau in the curve about here. The bottom panel shows you the extent of selection. That is, it's just the reciprocal of the mutant fraction in the population. That is, how rich is the population in the wild type? And that has this form as a function of D. So both of these have some kind of an optimization or an optimum around intermediate values of D or certain values of D. If you say that that's sort of an optimum, then if you project that all the way up to this exposure, this lac exposure line, that also predicts an optimum cycle time. That turns out to be 4 months. Okay. Now, there are some data in the literature about recolonization rates. And people have studied the E. coli in human intestinal systems. And they note that there are long periods where you have a resident strain of E. coli in your intestinal tract. But then occasionally, that will get washed out and you'll be recolonized by an entirely different strain. Okay. And the average time for that varies enormously from 2 months to a year. So you may, and what causes that turnover? No one really knows. Whether that's that you ate some spicy food in an Indian restaurant, or you have a diarrheal infection or something. But the average cycle time is, again, something that's not too far off from what we'd predict from these kinds of analyses. So what do these represent? As I said before, the cycling without colonization is about 24 hours. The colonization without cycling is something like 66 years. And this average rate of recolonization is about every 4 months. And I find this rather surprising that we started off analyzing a gene circuit for a very specific set of genes, and it ends up telling us something about the host and the relationship between that host and its environment. Now, I've told you.
I still don't understand this model at all in terms of steady state behavior when the parameters are changing, when you're going from the high state to the low state. Also, what does steady state mean? I think this one may have been your question, when you only have arrows going one direction. In other words, it seems that if you were really in steady state during either phase, you would get the wild type going down to zero.
Yeah. the steady state is kind of a particular one. It's not, what's happening is that you're going in one phase for one cycle and the other in the other. So it's kind of a sawtooth. And that pattern repeats. That's what I mean by a steady state. It's not that it's a single concentration where nothing changes. It's changing in each of those phases, but the pattern is a steady one. Pardon? Yeah, I guess you could say it's kind of a limit cycle. It's going up and down in a reproducible way. If you perturb it away, it comes back to that cycle. So it's limit cycle in that sense.
After it gets out of the body, immediately going in again?
The E. coli can survive for, the doubling time is about, or should say the decay rate, the halftime in the environment, it can be something like 2 days.
So, okay.
I can kind of understand how the E. coli would decide if it spends a lot of its time in nurseries and doesn't want to lose its ability to turn off the lac operon, it would tune the lac operon's various rates so that even in 24 hours it kept its behavior. But if it's getting washed out of your system
it doesn't in the sense that it's 2 months or whatever, that you're in the middle of that realizability region. So you've got a set of
No, I understand.
Okay.
2 months, but then there was this last thing in 66 years, and the E. coli never sits in one host for its lifetime. Why wouldn't there be any evolutionary pressure to take the lifetime of a host
Now, I just see that as setting a limit, that if you have that E. coli with its parameter values is actually adapted to staying with one host that long and still being able to maintain the selection of the control system.
So you're saying that there's
Now, it's just trying to put a limit on what is the longest cycle you could have. And the theory predicts that. 66 years with the parameters for the lac operon. And the question is, can you find anything that correlates with that? The only thing I can find that's sort of in that range is sort of the lifetime of the host. And then it sort of makes sense as a limit that...
E. coli normally just humans or...
No.
All kinds of animals.
Other warm-blooded animals. I don't know, I've been looking. There's some turtle that lives a long time. Maybe salmonella and that. I don't know what E. coli.
I know it's a very attractive argument that you think you do the lifespan of the host. But in the same way that E. coli finds its way once out of the gut into another host, you can do the same after the host dies.
Well, I mean, what I'm saying is it has to complete the cycle, which means, and that low demand part of the cycle is the environment. So it's got to do it within a week or two when it's dying out in the environment. It's got to complete the cycle. It would be really interesting, yeah, to have another organism that's associated with a different animal, with a different lifestyle and so forth. I've been trying to think of examples there's some that actually go through three different environments in the life cycle, like malaria or something. You go through, insect host as well as a human host. So you can imagine generalizing this to a cycle that has three components rather than just the high and low. But... I don't know of any good data yet. It's hard enough to get this with lac, when lac has been studied exhaustively for decades. Okay, I better go on. I want to finish some of the interesting things. I've simplified it, of course. Many of you know about the lac operon, know that it isn't just controlled by a repressor. In fact, that logic I showed you earlier says at least it's got two regulators. It's got the traditional lac repressor, and also a global regulator, the cap cyclic AMP protein. Oops. So now we want to look at regulation involving a combinatorial process where we've got to worry about the logic of those two interactions. We've got to worry about the phasing of those two interactions and the evolvability, again, the question of when you can realize this complicated control mechanism. So here's that logic argument again, and what you see is there are these four different states that are possible with these two regulators, and the only one where you get expression here is when you have the activator present and the repressor absent, okay? And turns out there are six possible life cycles that go with that, and let me try and explain this. On the top panel here, what I'm showing you here is the period of the absence of the repressor, okay? And over here is the presence of the activator, and you can see there's a phase relationship between these F. And in this case, for example, there's no overlap, so there wouldn't be any expression if you don't have an overlap where you've got the absence of the repressor and the presence of the activator. But now as you let this expand, here you get some period when there's expression, and into here you get a whole period of expression. This is the case when the phase plus the period for the absence of repressor is less than the cycle time, which I've normalized here to unity. And here's the case when that phase plus G is larger than one. And again, you can increase this, and you see that there are six possibilities for how you phase these different regulators. Well, you can do the same thing that we did with the simple case, and now instead of just a two-dimensional C versus D plot, we've got a four-dimensional plot. We've got the equivalent of D, which is the absence of the repressor, which I call G in this. You've got the presence of the activator, which is E, and you've got this phase between them, which is F. Those are the three parameters, and then you've still got the cycle time, C. So here is the envelope of that four-dimensional mound, and I want you to imagine that this is sort of spread out like a cigar. And on the right here, where there would be no interaction, as you change the, as you increase the phase, you begin to get a little overlap here where you could select for the control mechanism. That region expands as this sort of wing-shaped thing comes down, and eventually it closes off behind itself and you get this sort of sun. And as you move further on, this sun begins to set below the horizon and finally it goes away. So it's a complicated shape, but sort of like a long cigar. And that's the envelope of that mound. That's the realizability region for this control mechanism, which has two different regulators and their logic all wrapped up together. So you've got to be somewhere in that shaded cigar in order to have the control mechanisms.
So what was on the axis?
This is changing the phase between them. So you start off with no phase and you increase it.
And this is the length of one region
and another region. This is, if you like, the demand for the activator. This is the demand for the absence of the repressor. So that was like before we had D, these are like two different Ds for the two different kinds of regulators. And then, and C is still a fourth dimension, right? This is like the boundaries in the two-dimensional plot. This is what this corresponds to in the four-dimensional plot. Okay, well, we can talk about the rate and extent of selection just as we did in the simple case. And so if you think of being at the center of that cigar, sort of in an optimum position, what happens is if you change just the demand for the activator, here is the response time. Again, it comes down and has a sort of plateau. And here's the extent of selection. It goes again to an optimum. And here is varying the phase relationship between them. This actually has a minimum here. And here's the extent of selection with a maximum. And this is finally the demand for the absence of a repressor. Again, this kind of thing with a plateau and the peak here. So you can think of this as slices through that four-dimensional plot, and you're getting results very similar to what it was for the simple one regulator case.
And it's mathematically always true that the optimum are, because in essence, all the plots, the optimum are always aligning up against.
Well, this was picked to be at the optimum in the four-dimensional space. So, and we're taking slices through that optimum, in a sense. This is a way of trying to visualize what that four-dimensional object looks like. But it's having, it's showing you the same properties, more or less, that we saw with the simple repressor. So what does that look like? That prediction of that optimum says that there should be a long period where the repressor is present, that is, the thing is shut off because the repressor is bound. And here's where it's absent. There is this little thing at the end with a large phase between them. And this is the presence of the activator. It's there most of the time. And so if you expand it, it sort of looks like this around the end of the cycle. Right, and to have the maximum sort of extent of selection, that is, the most wild type that the control system can be. The fewest mutants, the minimum mutant fraction in the population. It's sort of that same optimum that we had with a simple case. Yeah, sort of. I think of this as sort of a robustness too. That by being in the middle of that region, you can tolerate some variations and not lose the control system. So, what's an interpretation of this in the particular case of the lac operon? It looks like this. There's this long period when there is no lactose when you're colonizing the gut, and here's the short period of 3 hours, sort of, when you see the lactose, and you got the absence of the repressor because the lactose removes the repressor. And for a while, you can utilize that lactose, but eventually what happens is you reach that one-third of the small intestine where the lactase enzymes are there, and it splits the lactose, and you get this flood of glucose coming on here. When that happens, glucose removes the activator, and beta-galactosidase transcription stops. For a period of time, you absorb the glucose and galactose with very active transport systems in your intestine, and there's a little bit of lactose left, so you get this little secondary induction of the lac operon, and then you go into this long period again where you don't see lactose.
So, this is a picture for a bug living in the stomach of someone who eats only lactose and no glucose.
This is looking at the lac operon as it's going through your system, in the bacterium as it's going through your system. So you're right. There's also glucose and galactose. It turns out you have very active transport systems in your intestinal tract that suck out galactose and glucose very efficiently. Okay, so you're not going to see it a lot in your small intestine or your intestinal tract. There are experiments that have been done where you take a concentrated solution of galactose, drink it, and it's just gone in no time. There is certainly glucose in our diet, but the argument here is that you probably absorbed a lot of it that was free glucose, if you like. This part you're getting from this catabolism of lactose at a certain local region in your intestine, because of the localization of the lactase enzyme. So this is a prediction of a kind of a bizarre pattern, but that's what is the optimum pattern comes out of this analysis, that you're predicting that if you could actually measure beta-galactosidase expression in this bacterium as it's going through your system, then it's going to have this two-phased pattern of expression. So this is where I'm saying that we're, in the end, trying to relate what happens at the phenotypic level. Well, here's the goal restated, that we're trying to go from the genotype to the phenotype, and I've tried to take one slice looking at this simple lac operon, and leads me to come to finish up with this another quote from Sidney Brenner. who says in that same article, if there's one important piece of information that's almost totally missing, that's the sequence information that specifies when and where and for how long a gene is turned on and off. And what I'm suggesting here is you're never going to find that in the sequence because it isn't coded in the sequence. It's this integrated behavior that depends on the environment, the physiology, the genes, all of this. And in fact, to put that together, these are the kinds of things we had to consider. We had to consider the sequence to get the sizes of the targets. We had to look at the molecular mechanisms, whether they were positive or negative, and the nature of those mechanisms, the circuitry of how they were interconnected, the physiology, LAC is an inducible catabolic system, the ecology, something about the gut and which and where it lives, and the selection pressures in these environments as it cycles through this, and try to put all that together into a model and with some computation that gives us the integration of all that information. And I think that's a good place to stop. I made it before noon.
Time for questions?
No.
Can you say anything about how many copies of a given transcription factor there are in the cell? Because you need at least one to bind to.
Yeah.
Presumably, you have many more than necessary.
Yeah. In the case of the LAC operon, there are about 10 to 30 copies per cell of the repressor. That's been measured. Pardon? Yeah, really put him on the spot. Is that monomers or?
10 tetramers.
10 tetramers, okay. So between 10 and 30, you're going to get something right.
Yeah. You can evolve that, right? If you've got a very sensitive, strongly binding molecule, you don't need many of them. But if you've got some more weakly binding system, because you have more of them, then you still end up with the same fraction of time to put down.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a theoretical. The equations that I solved gave you those asymptotic forms.
Yeah.
That was the theory. And then we put in numbers from E. coli, which sort of rounds out the corners with specific numbers.
The first diagram was an analytical attempt to solve the theory. The second
right.
diagram was a numerical attempt to solve the theory.
Right.
The numbers that went into the theory came from
E. coli. Came from E. coli, right. Yeah, looking at, say, a promoter, this is sort of using Gary Stormo's data about how large the targets are, say, for a promoter or a binding site for a repressor. And I forget now, what is it, 20 nucleotides or something like that, whatever that number is we put in there. And yeah, we basically made the assumption that any one of the bases in this target, if you mutate it, you essentially knocked out the activity for that. That's not absolutely true. There are some sites which are more sensitive than others, and you could probably tweak that a bit. But it's in the right ballpark.
And you're mutating every
base? Mutation rates were taken as the standard sort of 10 to the minus 10th per nucleotide per generation. Yeah.
Well, he
was talking about the multiple copies of the repressor, I believe. The number of copies of the operon itself are like one or two sort of copies, depending on how fast the organism is growing. And
these various mutation rates are associated with the thing that there's only one copy of, so it's not a problem.
It's the thing that there's one copy of. It's the, or the few copies of, yeah.
It would be divided.
Yeah.
So when you say LAC is uncoupled, you mean that LAC does not repress itself. LAC I does not. The repressor does not repress itself. Yeah.
Meaning if you look at the expression of the regulator and say beta galactosidase, you get 2,000-fold change in beta galactosidase Well, you don't see change in the repressor level less than twofold.
Okay. So it doesn't matter whether it doesn't matter why the repressor is kept at a constant level. In other words, it doesn't matter whether the repressor is regulating it or not regulating it.
That's right.
You would still call it a
repressor. Yeah. It's the coupling is a functional kind of definition. There are examples in those 35 that I showed you, for example, where the repressor or the regulator regulates its own expression as a repressor, but it's not affected by the inducer. So it's an autonomous little circuit, if you like.
So there's a recent paper that shows that LAC actually represses itself. Can you
see that? No, I haven't, actually. So I'd be interested in learning about it. For a long time, there were people who said it wasn't regulated, that it was somehow just a leaky transcription that occasionally things got through. But I would say that from the analysis, having the regulator regulate its own expression makes the system more robust. So you can almost predict that. But I hadn't been aware that there's evidence now of the LAC repressing its own repressor. Yeah?
I like one of your latest statements about the never seeing the sequence. Well, have to be coded in the sequence. This is very encouraging because many people have a tendency to demonize the sequence and the difference to be there. Actually, it's less there, and it's encouraging.
Well, at least in this one case, I think it is a cautionary note that I mean, a lot of these things come up for the integration. It's not in the sequence itself.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, sir.